KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Walla Walla counties. A group of people helping to decide what to do with a rotting totem pole in Tacoma says the century-old landmark should be taken down and left to decay in a public place as part of the city's living history. J.D. Elquist, a member of the advisory group, recently told the Tacoma City Landmarks Preservation Commission the pole should be laid to rest, possibly in a park, with signs telling its history. According to the News Tribune, the 83-foot pole at Fireman's Park had rotted so severely that it had to be braced. Consultants say it's a falling hazard. The commission will consider what to do with that pole at its June 12th meeting. Well, some say it's a big marketing ploy. Others say it is the most delicious salmon they've ever tasted and worth the hype. Today, the first Copper River salmon arrived in Seattle, launching the start of the season for the bright red and oily fish. The first plane load from Cordova, Alaska, landed this morning at SeaTac Airport, and the pilots carried a 40-pound king to the waiting chefs. The annual cook-off among local chefs this year includes Master Sergeant Robert Shulman, a 31-year Air Force Reserve chef representing the 446th Airlift Wing at Joint Base Lewis-McChord. The arrival of the fresh Copper River King and sockeye salmon is a rite of spring in Seattle, where the fish are prized for their flavor. I'm Lisa Brooks, KUOW News.
Support for NPR comes from Zurich Insurance, providing risk management and insurance solutions to help businesses meet their ever-changing needs. Learn more at ZurichNA.com. 55 degrees, overcast and wet in Seattle's University District this morning. It's going to be mostly cloudy for the rest of the day. We've got about a 50% chance of some more showers. We'll have a high of 64. Scattered showers tonight with mostly cloudy skies. Expect a low around 53. I'm Rob Wood. Can technology help journalists shield themselves and their sources from government intrusion? Warren Olney talks about that on To the Point later in the 11 o'clock hour. 94.9 KUOW, it's 10:06.
KUOW Seattle. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. We're coming to you this hour from the KUOW Performance Studio with a live audience of KUOW listeners, and we're so happy you're here, so welcome. It's been a wild, wild week if you're a Seattle basketball fan. Saturday, it looked like it just might be possible that Chris Hansen, Steve Ballmer, and the investment group that they had would bring the Sacramento Kings to Seattle as Sonics version 2.0. Alas, that's not to be. Meanwhile, state lawmakers are in the first week of their 30-day special legislative session. Will they get their work done this time? Just some of the many stories making headlines. And joining me today to talk about the news, Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger, C.R. Douglas, a political analyst for Q13 Fox News, and Knute Berger, the Mossback at crosscut.com. Nice to see you guys.
Good morning, all of you guys who are here.
Well, for the past couple of weeks, we've been talking about the Sonics, and I think this might be the last conversation that we have for quite some time. This morning it was reported that the Maloofs have agreed to sell the team to the Sacramento investment group headed by Mr. Ranadive. So no Chris Hansen, no 20%, no anything. But I guess my first question to the three of you is, if any of you were surprised that the Board of Governors actually voted to keep the Kings in Sacramento?
I wasn't. I mean, after that committee vote of, what, a couple weeks ago that we was unanimous not to approve relocation, I think it was clear kind of where it was going. I think, and I don't know where my colleagues will stand on this, or the audience for that matter, but I think the NBA made the right decision. I'm not one that loves teams moving around. And as much as I got caught up in this and thought it would have been fun, I think when you have a local group that has a team and a city that has come forward with a good arena deal, a good ownership group, you ought to give that the benefit of the doubt. Incumbent, sort of the advantage goes to the incumbent city, if you will, that has the team. So as much as it would have been fun to have basketball back here, and I think someday it will come back here, I think they did the right thing by keeping the team in Sacramento.
Eli, you agree?
I don't know how good the deal is for Sacramento. Their taxpayers are going to be putting a lot of money toward this stadium that is keeping the Sacramento Kings there. But there is a point to be made that we were essentially trying to do to them what happened to us. right? We didn't like it that our team disappeared, and of course Sacramento is not going to like it that their team disappeared. I don't know if this is the end. I kind of doubt it. Ballmer seems like a pretty determined guy. He's involved in the group that's trying to get a new team to Seattle. There's obviously a lot of anger in Seattle at a team not coming back to the city. We've been selling shirts at the Stranger that I can't quite describe on public radio,
but it
tells the NBA what it can do with itself. And you can find those at thestranger.com. But based on the reaction to those, there's obviously a desire to have a team here. And so you get that one of two ways, as far as I understand it, either by expansion or by luring a team out of another city. Obviously, it's not going to be Sacramento, but I don't think this is the last word.
Did any of the three of you see any of the David Stern news conference? You did, Knut?
Yeah, I watched it.
I watched it as well. And aside from the fact that he looked incredibly exhausted, I got the sense that expansion was not in the near future, i.e. no team for Seattle next week.
Well, they're certainly not committing to anything. And I thought there was a line that one of the columnists in Sacramento had about Seattle. And it's this kind of, it sort of speaks to, he said that Seattle was a bipolar city of limited introspection.
Wow.
And I there's some truth in that, I think, because a lot of the Sonics fans seem to have taken this thing of like, I hate the NBA, but you have to love us. You know, there's this sense of feeling betrayed by people who've already betrayed us. It's like, you know, how short is our civic memory here? I disagree with one thing you said, Marcy, in the very beginning, which is we weren't going to be talking about this.
We're
going to be talking about it a lot. And one of the reasons is that the momentum for the deal has been lost. You now have people who support the deal saying, Tim Burgess and Ed Murray both have kind of indicated they have some, you know, we better let this process kind of run out. Peter Steinbrück, of course, is the most vocal of the major candidates for mayor against the arena deal. And I mean, Mike McGinn doesn't want to talk about it. He's happy to let it go away, because it would have been a great political win for him if the team had come here this way. But Now what they have to look forward to is possibly no expansion team, a longer process of trying to steal a team from another town, Milwaukee or some other place, and then an EIS process that's coming up, which can drag on, and a lot of people both kind of disillusioned with what happened and being kind of reminded of what snakes the NBA is ownership and management are, and a lot of opportunity now to second guess every part of the deal. And one of the things is they raised the bid so much for that team that you have to say to yourself, well, if Chris Hansen can come up with an extra $75 million that he finds in the seat cushions of his couch, did Seattle really get enough out of the deal?
A lot of people,
did the port get enough?
A lot of people ask that question.
When you come to the EIS, it's all about mitigation. And what those guys have said is we have bottomless pockets. And so I think there's going to be a lot of negotiation coming up. This is assuming it doesn't fall apart, over what Hansen and company are going to have to pay to get that arena.
We're talking over the week's news with Knut Berger, C.R. Douglas, and Eli Sanders. And Eli, last week you were not around where we speculated on the political capital that Mayor McGinn would make, which now he will not make. But do you think that this hurts him? I mean, it's not really a negative. It's just not a positive, right?
Well, he's hurting in any case, if you look at his poll numbers. So he needs help. And this is help that he's not going to get for his mayoral campaign. And so in a sense, that's a hurt, or just a continuing hurt. And I think, as Knut alluded to, you're going to have this continuing talk in the mayor's race, or at least I would find an incentive to keep the talk going if I were one of the challengers, about the stadium deal. Mm-hmm. Because it reminds people that McGinn did not magically get Seattle a new basketball team. And if people blame him for that, that's good for his opponents. And then there is a lot to chew through on the stadium deal, and an opening for stadium critics if they can find a strong constituency like Steinbrück.
Sierra, you agree?
Well, yeah. I mean, as I think I said last week, that I think it is a sort of what might have been moment for McGahn that he is denied. I mean, had this relocation vote gone in our favor, you would have seen a spontaneous party in Pioneer Square that night, you know, beers on Chris Hansen, the mayor up with a bullhorn, you know, lapping in the praise and really sort of, you know, glowing in that win. So it would have been an important thing for him politically, especially for a guy that's getting criticized for not being able to bring people together and get big deals done. So he loses that, but it's not quite like some big, huge agenda that he puts before the city council and they get slapped down with the council no vote. I mean, no one thought that he sort of had the power to force the NBA to do this. So it's not quite a negative as it is a what might have been.
I think he definitely doesn't want to talk about it. And the evidence I have for that is that during the press conference, the David Stern press conference, Tim Burgess immediately sent out a statement about too bad the Sonics mm-hmm. aren't coming here, that kind of thing. McGinn's first email message said, more funding for road safety projects.
And
his statement didn't come out till much later.
It's true.
And additional evidence for that point, this morning his office sent out a press release saying he's going to announce new initiatives related to evidence-based policing, which is his continued campaign of talking about the main talking points of the other people in the mayor's race. You know, of course, Burgess has tried to make himself the man of evidence-based policing, and McGahn has started talking about that a lot more this election season.
Sierra?
I just want to jump back. You know, there's been kind of this argument you hear, especially from the Sonics fans, that there's somehow this hypocrisy with the NBA, that they, you know, they allow relocation when it was the Sonics leaving Seattle, and they don't allow relocation when it's, you know, the Kings coming back to Seattle. But I don't think I don't think the analogy is quite apt. I mean, take a moment and remind yourself of where we were in 2008 when they sort of allowed that relocation. I mean, we were not Sacramento. We had several times in the state legislature turned down attempts at a new stadium. You know, right. Schultz tried, Clay Bennett tried. In the middle of all this, we were a city that was passing Initiative 91 that said basically no money for sports stadiums. We had all kinds of fatigue about the Safeco Field and even CenturyLink Field. This was not a team that was lighting people up. Sacramento did everything that we did not do in 2008.
I want to talk about the current arena deal, this five-year memorandum of understanding, which is still in effect. I asked both Dow Constantine and Mike McGahn about that, because it seems, as I think, Knut, you alluded to, that there may not be the will to follow through on this, and not only will the port perhaps ask more, but I think a lot of people now can step back because the timetable is nothing. Nobody knows what the timetable is, and say, is this really the right location, and what do we want this area south of Pioneer Square to look like? I mean, do you think that that's what's going to happen?
Yes, I do, because one, there's going to be a discussion about, it's already been raised in terms of the industrial uses versus the kind of gentrification or, I don't know, yuppification, whatever you want to call it, of SoDo. So that debate is already out there, and that will get more intense. And then there will be a debate about, even if the arena eventually happens, how far are we going to let that sort of LA style entertainment district or whatever it evolves into? Their property, they're you know, people buying up property down there in speculation, and you know, so this issue about our sort of industrial base and family wage jobs and the kind of union economy and industrial economy, I don't think that's going to go away. I think, you know, what they've lost is momentum and a kind of sense of inevitability. It's really hard to imagine, if we'd gotten the team, that there would have been the political will in the city to have a hard look at the EIS. Now they don't have that pressure. They can take a hard look.
We're talking over the week's news this hour, as we do every Friday, with Knut Berger, C.R. Douglas, Eli Sanders, a performance studio full of KUOW listeners, and you here on Weekday on 94.9 KUOW.
94.9 KUOW. It's 10:19.
Support for KUOW comes from the EnviroStars Business Certification Program, recognizing EnviroStars Garden of Whedon in Shoreline for its commitment to environmentally sustainable business practices. A directory of businesses meeting certification standards is available at envirostars.org.
56 degrees and overcast in Seattle's U District. It's going to be mostly cloudy for the rest of the day. We've got about a 50% chance of some more showers. Expect a high this afternoon around 64. Scattered showers are in our forecast for tonight. It'll be mostly cloudy with a low around 53.
KUOW and the Wing Luke Museum present Under My Skin, Artists Explore Race in the 21st Century. On display starting May 10th, this exhibit features the work of 26 artists who challenge the conventional ways we think about race. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
I'm Rob Wood. Tavis Smiley continues his conversation with legendary director Mel Brooks and previews his upcoming PBS American Masters special. Just one of the things you'll hear this afternoon from 1 till 2 here on 94.9 KUOW.
From KOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman, and it is Friday, the 10 o'clock hour, and this is when we talk over the week's news with our panel of journalists, C.R. Douglas, Eli Sanders, Knute Berger, all here. We're live in the KOW Performance Studio with a group of KOW listeners, and we don't normally do this in front of a live audience, so it's very fun. Thanks for coming in. We were talking about the Soto area, the arena, and the fact that the Kings will not become the Sonics. That'll have to be some other team that comes here. And I know as we were taking the break, Eli, you said you had just one little thought that you wanted to add.
Well, I thought there was an interesting thing that we learned from all of this. We think, especially in Seattle now, about the NBA as this group of avaricious, money-grubbing, you know, mean-spirited people who are doing our city wrong. But there's this illustrated that if you give the NBA a choice between more private money and less public money, what the NBA wants is public money, which is a little odd to me, but I'm not a huge sports fan or expert about the NBA, but this will be instructive going forward. What the NBA wants is for taxpayers to subsidize teams. It doesn't appear that they want more money from private individuals, which is, by the way, the opposite of what the city of Seattle wants. And so there's, in addition to all the other clashes here, there's a philosophical clash. Seattle is very much against public money or excessive public money for stadiums and teams. And for some reason, which I don't quite understand, the NBA is all for that.
Well, it's interesting. George just emailed in, and you can email in as well, weekday@kuow.org. He says, why do we take the NBA monopoly as a given? The NBA has been raiding the treasuries of American cities for generations. I'd rather pay for a municipal league team owned by Seattle that plays that other cities. I'm reading this wrong. That plays well in other city-owned teams like Green Bay. I wondered, couldn't somebody at one time there were more than one basketball professional leagues, were there not? So isn't it possible that somebody with as deep pockets as Steve Ballmer, if he really wants basketball, just start another league?
Well, I mean, the NFL tried a second league. That didn't work. The emailer talks about, you know, a publicly owned team like Green Bay. That is the only example in the entire country of any of the leagues. They do not like that. They hate municipalities and the concept of them owning a team. That's not a great sort of partner to negotiate with. One thing to say about expansion, I mean, I think the deal is still alive. He's got 5 years, Chris Hansen, right, to sort of shop this arena around and say, hey, I've got a deal. I think it's, you know, another team may come up, but they don't come up that often. I think his biggest hope is expansion, which we've already talked about. But that's, you know, that's not a given. The thing about expansion is it's got to come in pairs. I mean, you don't just expand one team. You have to expand two because you want an even number. The NBA has 30 teams. You don't go to 31, you screw everything up. You got to go to 32. So if you allow an expansion in Seattle, you're also talking about an expansion somewhere else. Not out of the question. But to dilute this TV revenues, to dilute the talent pool, I mean, there's all kinds of reasons why they resist expansion, even though it would be, you know, a big cash payment to them. I mean, Ballmer and company would have to pay about $500 million, $600 million to get the expansion team. Owners would split that. So there is money to them, but there's also a disincentive financially when they're sharing TV revenue and all the rest.
It just occurs to me, three political journalists, you've had to learn a lot about the ins and outs of professional sports, haven't you, to talk about this. Let's switch to politics now, unless you feel really compelled to keep talking about this.
Were we just on politics?
Yeah, we were. Let's talk about federal politics, because it's been quite a week for the president. In short order, it was revealed that an IRS manager had sanctioned special scrutiny for groups with Tea Party or Patriot in their names when they were applying for a 501c4 nonprofit status. The Justice Department was probing the Associated Press on grounds of national security. The White House released dozens of emails in an attempt to distance itself from discussions about who was trying to control the conversation about the attack on the American embassy in Benghazi, Libya. And now they're just trying to play catch up. And Well, do you want to start with any one of these in particular, or this is like one fell hammerhead to the Obama administration?
Well, it was certainly a lousy week from a PR standpoint, and in some cases a substantive standpoint. I would put scandals in quotes. I think the Benghazi thing, it was interesting. There was so much noise about it. But the supposed sort of smoking gun document was a series of emails about the talking points that the CIA and the State Department had had a hand in. These have been in the hands of the Congressional Committee for some time, some weeks. Somebody leaked some of those to the press, but they leaked doctored versions that made the White House look more culpable than in fact it was. And when the actual emails came out, it demonstrated that the Republican operatives were going out of their way to try to make the administration look bad. So from the Benghazi standpoint, it was actually substantively a better week than it looked. Now, whether that is lasting or not, is obviously open ended. The IRS thing is, completely outrageous. And the question is, that people rush to the judgment about, Obama's the new Nixon. Well, if they can find that Obama ordered this, as Nixon ordered his aides to harass and use the IRS to harass political opponents, if you found that tie or that link, yeah, that would be a Nixon-esque kind of thing. But if this is a matter of compliance people at the IRS kind of carrying out their own, personal thing, it's extremely troubling. But more details have to be learned. But it appears that this was some relatively low-level people who were targeting the Tea Party in ways that you just don't want to see the IRS targeting any political groups. The other problem is the AP story, and that it'll be interesting to see whether that has legs, in part because a lot of Republicans have been pushing for cracking down on leaks and pushing the Obama administration to be tougher on national security stuff. And so it's very difficult for them to turn around and suddenly say, this shouldn't have happened. But it certainly is something that is a strike against Obama from the standpoint of the press.
Well, they have turned around and said this shouldn't happen.
I was just going to say that. Nothing apparently is stopping them, at least in their own internal monologue, from turning around and doing exactly the opposite of what they, in other instances, say would like to have done. The Benghazi show is also aimed at Hillary Clinton, of course. This is what the Republicans know how to do with a Clinton: investigate, insinuate political considerations above the good of the American people, or in this case, above the good of national security. I mean, what they're driving toward is an attack on Hillary Clinton's readiness to be commander-in-chief should she run in 2016. And then in the short term, it's just another part of snaring Obama in, multiple complicated scandals that he has to try to manage, whether they go all the way back to him or not, while he's trying to get something done in his second term. I mean, he was saying this, I think, at a fundraiser in New York the other day. I was hoping to get something done.
Well, does this paralyze him for 3.5 years?
Hopefully not.
Well, I don't know if it paralyzes him for 3.5 years, but it's certainly a setback. I mean, he was already having problems with his second term agenda, be that in guns, immigration, climate control, all the rest. And you add to this three sort of big scandals. I mean, in quotes, sure, but three big problems. Mm-hmm. You're going to have congressional investigations in all of them. You sort of throw the president off his agenda. It sets things back for him at a crucial time. I mean, this is the time, the fertile time to get things done. You're sort of in the sort of early months of a pre-election year. You know, when it starts getting into the fall and certainly the beginning of the next year, everything changes and you get a whole lot tougher dynamic about getting things done. So this, we're far enough away from the election. This is sort of ripe time to get something done. And if you chew up a lot of time during the spring, during the summer, during the fall on these, when everything else gets pushed aside, that's definitely bad for Obama. But I will say also it's bad for Republicans. I mean, they need some important wins here legislatively. They need immigration reform. I mean, they'd love to get entitlement reform out of this president, and there were some gestures toward that. If this all ruins the legislative agenda, it ruins some important things they need to get done as well.
Can the Obama administration or Obama himself manage to lift himself beyond this? Because right now, he either looks like somebody who knows nothing about what his government is doing, or else somebody who is Nixonian in that sense.
Well, there's that joke about the way the media comes up with a trend. If it happens three times, it makes a trend. So you've got three scandals, and there's a trend, and Obama is sinking, and the sky is falling. But we all know from coming here to discuss the news every week that the channel really changes in a big way very often from week to week. 3 weeks ago, or 2.5 weeks ago, all we were talking about was Boston. Mm-hmm. And it's very conceivable that in another week something else will have come up, or the public attention will have shifted, and these things that seem all-consuming this week will have blown over. There was that poll that went around this week that showed the public really is not that interested in Benghazi and is not even sure what the scandal is. We know that the public is not really fond of the media, and so the media definitely thinks it's a scandal that the Justice Department was investigating it, but I think most people don't really care about journalists and don't like people leaking national security secrets, so in a way, that hatred of the media may benefit Obama. And then with the IRS, the head of the IRS has been fired, or resigned, I guess.
Forced to resign,
in that delicate Washington term.
Our listener, Diane, emails, from the point of view of trying to detect tax avoidance, who should the IRS give greater scrutiny to than Tea Party groups who scream from the rafters how much they hate paying taxes in general?
That is a very good point. However, the mission of the IRS is to be fair to all Americans, and you can't have a revenue service that is or even appears to be targeting some groups over others. But yes, that's a fair point that's occurred to me as well in this discussion. You have groups that have stated pretty clearly that they are really opposed to our current tax structure, and even I think talked about avoiding taxes.
CR?
Well, I would say both sides are using this 501c4, mm-hmm. you know, loophole, if you will. I mean, you got a lot of Democratic money that's going into this, a lot of Republican money. So it's not just that one side's using it. Obviously, it's clear only one side was being investigated by the IRS, and that is wrong, and everyone's, you know, outraged about that.
Well, you bring up the bigger question, and a question I had as well, which is about who should get nonprofit tax-exempt status anyways. I think this comes off of the Citizens United Supreme Court ruling, doesn't it? I mean, it's one of the outgrowths of it.
And there's questions about whether the IRS has enough guidelines, or whether there are other agencies that should weigh in. But, you know, when you get into politics and religion and education, those are very difficult places to draw bright lines in terms of behavior. One of the Tea Party groups, I think it was the one in the Tri-Cities mm-hmm. that had such trouble, and there was a story on KOW about it, and they were talking about how the IRS, one of the functions that their group wanted to do was have a book club, and the IRS demanded the reading list of the book club.
Really?
Yeah. So this isn't just this went beyond merely a kind of technical. It was taking, you know, using ideology to essentially profile these groups, and then drilling down and really getting into the detail of what they were thinking. And so you have to find a way with these laws to have them both make sense, but also there has to be you have to be extremely careful about preserving people's liberty, preserving people's right to read what they want, believe what they want.
Just one last two last words. Hillary Clinton. What does this do to her?
Well, I mean, as Eli said, and I think correctly, there is something about the Benghazi obsession that has to do with Hillary Clinton. But up to now, they have not been able to really get Hillary, the Republicans, as much as they've tried. I mean, look at Whitewater and the obsession they had in the 1990s. Well, she goes on and becomes a senator. That didn't stop that. They tried to not have her become senator. That didn't work. So Hillary Clinton has won every time Republicans have tried to take her down. So this is, you know, partly an attempt to do that, but she's got a great track record against it.
She even declared that she's running for president?
No, she hasn't. But a lot of this is just presumption. But one thing that is known is that the Clintons, both of them, Hillary and Bill, are incredibly effective on behalf of the Democratic Party. Bringing her down, even if it doesn't dirty her for 2016, it can maybe dent the effectiveness of both Clintons for 2014. And that will be a battle for the House and Senate. And so I think there's a way in which if you can weaken the Democratic messengers, the problem is the Clintons have almost always been able to turn scandals about them into scandals about Republican politics. Clinton survived in not only survived impeachment, he seemed to thrive after impeachment. And that whole process boomeranged on the Republicans and damaged them.
I was just going to say there's a sense in which attacking the Clintons ultimately only makes them stronger. They are very skillful at maneuvering into that spot. And so in terms of fundraising for Democrats, being the target of, from Democratic viewpoints, ill-founded congressional investigation is only going to make people more willing to give to Hillary, more supportive of her, or at least will be an incentive to rally around her.
I just had an image of the Clintons as those professional wrestler villains who are always encouraging the crowd, hate me more,
Jerry emails in, the IRS has had a third more applications for 501c4 status, plus the government cutback by Republicans. Why haven't we included that in this discussion? I didn't know the number of applications, but I know there has been a rush, and it's political groups, I think.
Well, absolutely. There have been a big surge in applications for this because, and it goes back to Citizens United. I mean, now that you have sort of unlimited contributions, these sort of vehicles have proliferated. This one is particularly attractive because it's anonymous. These don't require reporting of the donors. So a lot of people have gone there for that very reason. And like I said, both sides have done it. But Citizens United, where you allowed kind of this unlimited corporate money, has sort of pushed this forward.
Talking over the week's news and its implications with our panel of journalists, C.R. Douglas, who's a political analyst for Q13 Fox News. Knut Berger is the Mossback at crosscut.com, and he also blogs at Seattle Magazine. Eli Sanders, associate editor of The Stranger, I believe on sabbatical for just a few precious more weeks, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, you're right.
Enjoy it.
But still blogging for The Stranger.
But still blogging. I'm Marcy Silman, and we're going to take a quick break and be back and maybe move the conversation a little more local here on KUOW.
.10:38 now at KUOW.
Support for KUOW comes from Consolidated Press, serving Seattle since 1934, offering full-color web, sheet-fed digital printing, binding, and mailing services. 206-447-9659 or on the web at consolidatedpress.com.
56 degrees and overcast right now in Seattle's University District. Expect mostly cloudy skies for the rest of the day. We've got about a 50% chance of some more showers. We'll see a high this afternoon of about 64. Scattered showers are in our forecast tonight. It'll be mostly cloudy with a low around 53. And tomorrow looks like kind of a sloppy day. Cloudy sky, showers are likely. We'll have a high of about 60.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Pacific Seminary, hosting a day for prospective students to meet faculty, attend class, and connect with current students. Tuesday, May 21st at 2:30. More at spu.edu/seminary. Seattle Pacific University, engaging the culture, changing the world.
I'm Rob Wood. Well, it's that time of year to start hitting garage sales. What's the best or most unusual treasure you've ever gotten at a garage sale? Call our listener feedback line now and tell us about it at 206-221-3663 and tell us what it is and how you got it. That's 206-221-3663. Join us as we talk garage sale tips and tales later at 1240.
David Byrne's great new disco musical about the life of Imelda Marcos. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Hear that Sunday night at 7 o'clock here on 94.9 KUOW.
This is Weekday on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman, and we are live in the KUOW Performance Studio this morning with a group of KUOW listeners patiently looking at us. And, you know, you can make noise at any time. Also, a panel of journalists, Knute Berger, C.R. Douglas, Eli Sanders. We were talking feds. Let's talk state. The legislature went back into session on Monday, and it's been pretty quiet, except for Governor Inslee, who, it seems, scaled back a bit his expectations for lawmakers. Knute, you wrote about that this week.
Well, I did. I was at an event on Monday. It was a luncheon. CR was interviewing the governor on stage. It was televised. One of the interesting things about it was how he narrowed his agenda for the special session. Which I'd like to point out, I don't know why they call it special session, because we've had, 41 of them since 1980.
Yes.
So it's kind of business as usual, but nevertheless, it's a 30-day window to get a lot of stuff done. Of course, the biggest thing is the budget and how to fund the increase in education spending.
Which is mandated.
Which is mandated by the courts. It's a billion to $1.2 billion issue, and of course a lot hangs on that because it has to do with whether Republicans and Democrats coming to some agreement about revenues and where they're going to come from or not, cuts. So that's obviously a big item. Another item on his agenda, which I thought was kind of interesting, was a transportation bill that sounds very kind of maintenance-oriented, at least as in terms of how it's being pitched, which is sort of, you know, he said a bipartisan transportation bill that sort of deals with what we already have. So not a big visionary plan. And then the third thing was getting some bipartisan action on drunk driving. That seems to be probably the closest to actually happening. I think the Republicans and Democrats are going to work something out. But an interesting thing was thrown into the mix on that this week when a national group recommended changing the drunk driving standard from, 0.8 alcohol level to 0.5.
Right.
Many countries use 0.5. They find impairment happens much sooner, and that strict enforcement at that level really dramatically reduces highway deaths. So that's something the state hasn't been considering as part of its crackdown. Now that's been kind of thrown into the mix as something to think about.
C.R., I'm curious, were you surprised that the governor had scaled back what he was really going to call on? Because just a couple weeks ago, he was still talking grand vision.
No, I wasn't surprised because he's having enough trouble getting a budget through that to have a special session where you're not just trying to do that, but you're also trying to do background checks, what they call reproductive parity, which is abortion coverage and insurance policies, and what they've also called the DREAM Act, which is getting financial aid for some undocumented kids for schools. All three of those were particularly controversial this session.
Right.
They all died at some level. And to try and resurrect them, these really bitter fights in a special session where you still do not have a budget deal, was just biting off too much. And he was just going to get too much resistance. So to scale it down was certainly the right thing to do politically. But it does not mean that they are any closer. It is still about $1 billion that separates the sort of governor and Democrats, if you will, from the Senate, which is really controlled by Republicans, and they're still at loggerheads about how to bring those two sides together.
Have they made any progress at all?
Well, they say they've made progress on what they call assumptions. So in addition to just sort of we want more money, we don't want more money, there are all kinds of disagreements about, well, if, you know, how much would we save if we cut that program? How much would we actually generate if we, you know, tinkered this policy? I mean, there's some assumptions that both sides just have disagreed on. So they've come together on some of those assumptions, if you will, about what it would cost if you did X mm-hmm. versus Y. So that's at least some progress. But on the big issue, and face it, this is the big issue, do you raise taxes or not? They're showing no signs of any breakthroughs.
I asked if they'd made any progress, and Eli starts shaking his head, no.
And, you know, Knut alluded to this, but it's like Groundhog Day. Every year in Olympia, we go through a regular session, and somehow it's too hard to do this in a regular session. So we go to a special session and then an extra special session. It is not difficult to see the problem. We need $1 billion at least. And no one has come forward with a plan that can get enough support to get that money. But no one has also explained how we're going to get that money beyond raising revenue and closing tax loopholes. We haven't heard a credible plan. So it's extremely frustrating to watch in the end. The legislators in Olympia say, well, it's just so complicated. We need more time to sort it out. It's not that complicated. And if we agree, which we all have for a long time, that the budget is the core issue, then you would think that all those minds in Olympia could get together and at least come up with credible proposals for how to get that $1 billion and then find support for it. Of course, the support is the problem in the end, and you have an incentive on the part of a lot of Republicans to just stall.
Isn't there a one more revenue forecast to come out before the end of the special session, and might they not be waiting to see if that bails them out a little bit?
Well, it's actually after the special session, so it's okay. A 30-day special session, which ends in June 11th. I think the revenue forecast comes out the 19th, so it's after the session ends. But the last revenue forecast, I think the net increase was like $40 million. I mean, mm-hmm. it does look like we've troughed as a state. We're suddenly starting to get a little more revenue, but it's not like we had a $1 billion change in the forecast. Right. I mean, it's unlikely to be a game changer, and it's going to come so late in the game. I mean, they need a new budget by July 1st, which is when the fiscal year of the state starts. So they can't really wait until June 19th to get this deal out.
Although, and so the question is, what are they waiting for? They're not waiting for the revenue forecast. That's not credible because like CR said, there's not going to be $1 billion that suddenly appear. What's the delay?
Well, they're waiting for who's going to blink. This is about, is the governor and the Democrats, are they so, you know, gung-ho about new revenue that they're going to just absolutely go to the mat for it? Will they ever blink and agree to $500 million of revenue and not $1 billion of revenue? Will Republicans blink on this very hard line, no new taxes, no new revenue? We can get it in cuts and savings. Who's going to blink first?
Since we have an audience here, and I'm sorry, radio listeners, because you won't be able to see them, how many of you who are sitting with us in the performance studio think that we're going to see higher taxes at the end of this legislative session? A third of you. What do you guys think?
Well, my question is, how many of the people here want higher taxes or more revenue?
How many people? Well,
so that's more than half, or closing loopholes.
Right, so these are KUOW listeners, and I'm sure emailers will email in to say it's a highly select group.
I'm not saying it's a scientific poll, but
not in the slightest.
It's people who I would imagine mostly live in Seattle, and it's maybe just another reminder of the frustration that people, especially in Seattle, feel, where it seems blindingly obvious what needs to be done. If you don't want to raise revenue, at least close loopholes. We've got $6 billion worth of loopholes in this state and $1 billion to find. Maybe we could do that.
You know, when Inslee talks about education, he makes his strongest case is looking to the future, talking about the sort of energy efficient economy, talking about innovation, wanting STEM programs, ways of training the next generation of scientists and engineers. And he framed it really well by saying that one of the revenue sources that he wants is an extension of the tax on professional services.
Mm-hmm.
And basically saying, look, you know, we don't need to give tax breaks to lawyers. Washington has a lot of lawyers. The lawyers aren't fleeing the state for lack of business. But we do need more scientists and engineers, and we need to put money into training those people. And I think that he, one of the arguments about the revenue side, I mean, I don't think new taxes, it depends on how you define it. You know, do you define an extension of an existing tax as a new tax? If you don't, then there's some opportunity there.
Well, I don't think the governor does, because he pledged no new taxes.
Yeah, so whether he can convince enough people right. in the Senate to agree on
correct.
That.
He does not see that as a new tax, and that was very much a campaign pledge to not raise taxes. So so he's you know, claiming he wouldn't break his campaign promise. The billion, if you will, the Democrats are asking for is kind of in two pots and almost equal. About
half a billion
would come from what Knut's talking about, which is this extension of a business tax for professional services, lawyers, doctors, etc. The other half are kind of these loopholes. And my guess is that the tax on professional services will probably expire. And that will probably die. I don't think Democrats are going to get that. I think where you see new revenue, it's going to come from closing these loopholes. I think that's probably has the most chance. I think Republicans are more comfortable with that. I mean, one example of a tax loophole they want to close, if you are from out of state and you come into Washington, you do not pay sales tax on goods here. If you come from a state that doesn't have pay sales tax. So, for instance, if you're from Oregon and you come here, you do not have to pay sales tax on the refrigerator you buy and whatever you do. So you got a lot of Oregons coming here. They want to get rid of that exemption. And that's not one that sort of feels like this general tax increase for everyone, right? I mean, many people feel like, well, I can't believe that's happening. You know, why should we allow that?
I don't know, more general question about state tax revenues and local budgets. King County Executive Dow Constantine was in the studio yesterday pushing hard for a motor vehicle excise tax, or not just the authority to levy the tax in King County. He was maybe as heated as this man ever gets, which isn't very heated if you've ever seen him. He's pretty calm, sort of hot under the collar. And off mic, I'm sorry, Dow Constantine, but I have to reveal this. We talked again about how much of the state's revenues come from the central Puget Sound region and how much does not return back to this region. And he was joking, but he said, if you do the numbers, we could fund the University of Washington from King County.
And this is not a request for money from the rest of the state. This is a request for authority to tax ourselves to keep our public transit running.
Do you think he's going to get that permission?
I think he likely will. I mean, they've given it before. Metro faces huge budget cuts, but this does irk. I mean, sort of the urban Democrats, if you will, down Olympia are just livid, because if you by not being able to get this authority, we're just asking, as Eli says, they say, we're just asking for authority to then go out to our voters or to have our own legislators raise, you know, money for transit. But because when you look at the state budget, I mean, sort of King County, the big counties tend to be donor counties. You know, they get back, you know, less than a dollar for every dollar they put in the state budget. And a lot of these sort of eastern Washington counties get more back than for every dollar. And they're the ones that have been against giving places like King County the authority to just go to their voters and ask for local taxes. So it just, you talk to Democrats and they're absolutely outraged that they're not even allowed to get this authority. I think in the end they will get it, but that's an ongoing fight.
If you're a real hardliner and you're anti-tax, you know, some of the Republicans have taken the position that they don't want to increase the ease with which taxes can be raised anywhere in the state. So that's the kind of
is this
mentality.
Like the door opens and then everybody's going to be clamoring for taxes?
Yeah, and they just don't want to have to be on the hook for being anywhere responsible for tax increases anywhere down the food chain. The problem is, if you know, the government is doing less on transportation, the federal government, the state government is doing less, you know, you're basically pushing the responsibility for various functions down to the local level, which actually is a very Republican thing, then the local officials want to be able to have the right to meet the expenses and needs of there. So it's a perfectly you know, reasonable request. And as far as Metro goes, pretty essential, because the cuts and shortfalls and in services and that would result are really appalling.
Well, let's bring this conversation back local. 400 people showed up. I believe it was King Street Station. Was it Union Station? One of the train stations, for a public hearing, which was really pretty much not about convincing the King County Council not to make cuts, but seemed more like a pep rally toward the aimed at the legislature, like see how much support we have for our public transportation system.
Well, and just maybe it isn't clear, to raise taxes locally for public transportation requires state authority. So you get a certain amount of sort of envelope, if you will, on your sales tax, on your motor vehicle excise tax, and that is granted to you by the state. Mm-hmm. So what King County and other leaders are trying to do is get the state to sort of increase that authority so that they can then go out to their voters or just do it sometimes with their own legislature.
I think they're planning to do some of it themselves.
Right. But in any case, you would need the authority from Olympia. So that's the fight. Olympia, allow us to do this. Otherwise, Metro faces, 17%?
17% cuts. And what Constantine said yesterday is that what we would see is less of what he called the spider web network of service regionally, but more things like the rapid ride lines that they're starting to put in, so that you'd have to drive or bike or somehow get yourself to a main line.
I mean, I think the only thing they can do without state authority is raise bus fares, which I think they are including another 25-cent fare increase, but they've increased fares a lot.
I understand that somebody suggested at this public hearing that they follow the public radio method and just put a big bucket and solicit donations on the buses. So,
what if Republicans at the state level who are opposed to this follow their own ideology? Aren't they always talking about local control, let the people decide whether they want to be taxed, don't impose this from above? You know, this is what is happening here. People in Seattle want to be taxed.
I just want to put a plug in for a series of stories on Crosscut this week by Doug McDonald, the mm-hmm. former head of the Department of Transportation, looking at the House's proposal for a big transportation bill and really eviscerating it. One of the things is it's billed as something that would maintain things as they are, but only about 11% of the money in that budget would actually go to highway maintenance, and the rest is big new freeway projects.
Wow.
But he talks about the issue of prioritization based on where the greatest need is. So he had a great phrase. He said in the transportation business, spreading transportation money around to these different constituencies is called peanut buttering.
Peanut buttering?
peanut buttering the state, making sure everybody gets a little bit of the spread.
Mm.
But one of the things he pointed out was the huge crying need from an infrastructure standpoint is fixing I-5, and particularly I-5 from South Tacoma to Snohomish County line. And just when you look at a pure numbers of people who use a piece of infrastructure, this is the corridor where, 2/3 of the people in the state live. And it's just a really great series of kind of looking at how these issues are really interlinked and how the politics often funds money instead of money going to something like, transit in Seattle, where it's desperately needed. It ends up going to other projects that really aren't particularly needed when you look at it in a more global sense.
Well, welcome to politics. I mean, the way these sort of nickel increases in the gas tax and all these other things are sort of approved is because everyone gets a little bit of a piece of that pie. So you're in the Okanagan and you got something, and if you're in Seattle, you got something. I will say, I think that's very right, but I will say there have been a couple big projects that the state has funded in the sort of Seattle area. I mean, 520, they put in several billion. The viaduct, they put in several billion. So a lot of the rural people say, hey, we've done a lot for you guys.
We've been talking over the week's news with our panel of journalists making a special appearance, like the special session. C.R. Douglas, political analyst for Q13 Fox News. Regular panelist Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger, back with us. And Knute Berger is the Moss back at CrossedCut.com and the author of Space Needle, The Spirit of Seattle. Thanks, all three of you, for being here. And thanks to our special performance studio audience, to our engineers, Doug Patterson, Tim Meinig, and John Sullivan. Our show is produced by Katie Sewell with Jason Pagano, Amina Al-Sadi, Rob Woods, our engineer. I'm Marcy Silman. Monday, Temple Grandin will be with us, and Tuesday, Walter Mosley. Lots of other great guests, so tune in next week to Weekday on KUOW Seattle.
President Obama is focusing on job creation today in Baltimore. We'll hear more in the headlines just ahead. This is KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. We're online at KUOW.org.
Support for KUOW comes from Vitreo Retinal Associates of Washington, announcing the opening of a new office in Montlake Terrace to serve patients from Snohomish and North King counties with retinal problems such as macular degeneration. More at VRAWashington.com.
Well, let's see here. 56 degrees, overcast right now in Seattle's University District. A weather system will move into western Washington today. It'll produce both showers and sun breaks. A stronger system will push into the area tomorrow. It'll give us a showery, cooler day. For the most part, we'll see mostly cloudy skies today, about a 50% chance of showers, a high of 64. Scattered showers tonight, a low of 53. And tomorrow, it's going to be cloudy with showers likely.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.